This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hey, you're listening to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. Everything that Tom, Rich and myself have been up to on the last day of the week. Friday, 15th of March. And a really busy one on the numbers front. We've had the oversubscription numbers for the Parkin IPO. We knew there were going to be more takers than shares. We just didn't know by how much. 165 times how much was the answer. We've been speaking to Dean Kemble, who's the Chief Commercial Officer at GSB Capital, about what that tells us about our IPO pipeline prospects going forward. We've also been looking with Dean at the numbers coming up from two major UAE companies, DP World and Majid Al Futtaim, both reporting their 2023 full-year earnings. Richard has been doing the macro shuffle for us this morning, speaking to one very well-regarded economist, Jason Schenker, out of Texas, to put into context those inflation numbers that we got from the US this week and where that might be taking us and the Fed. And we've had listener-turned-show pundit. Arnold Cart is the first to message us in whenever we mention Bitcoin. We've had him in this morning to talk us through what's happening with Bitcoin from the bull's perspective. Where we are on company numbers watch this morning, whether that is visitors turning up at the Trade Centre for exhibitions, whether that is the amount of oversubscription we've had for the Parkin IPO, or whether that is numbers from two bellwether companies here that tell us different things about the economy. Let's start with the last of those. We've had DP World and we've had MAF, Majid Al Futtaim, coming out with their numbers, which we look at to tell us what's happening in the wider economy. In the case of DP World, it's the global economy, people moving stuff from A to B, tell us a lot about the health of what's going on there and what might be to come. Plus, Majid Al Futtaim's got fingers in so many pies, shopping malls, hotels, shops themselves, supermarkets, and of course it has branched out into the real estate industry proper. We can kind of look at it as a way to look at what's happening in Dubai as a whole. We have got one investment analyst on the show a little bit later on to put those earnings in context for us, but let's get the economist's take first. Dan Richard, senior economist at Emirates NBD, has been looking at DP World and Majid Al Futtaim.
With the global slowdown and turn away from goods to experiences coming out of a pandemic, DP World has had a bit of a harder time of it recently, with net profits down on the previous year and a company warning about an uncertain outlook due to geopolitical and macroeconomic headwinds. Nevertheless, the company still plans to invest in further developing Jebel Ali, underlining the importance of the facility and the sector to the company and to Dubai itself. The year was somewhat stronger for Majid Al Futtaim, with net profit up 12% last year, while the company is also facing challenges from regional developments given its presence in Egypt. The robust growth in footfall at its malls in Dubai helped to drive it to profit.
And Dean Kemble from GSB Capital is going to be on a little bit later to put those in context, but that is Dan Richards, senior economist at MBD. That is one set of numbers. Tom has been looking at another, which is the Dubai World Trade Centre numbers.
Yeah, we're going to be looking at these in more details a little later on this morning. In fact, next hour we're going to be joined by the team from Dubai World Trade Centre, Mahia Abdul Karim, I should say. Julfa will be joining us live here on the show via Microsoft Teams to talk about their latest numbers. 2023 numbers are out in terms of number of participants who took part in the various MICE events, meetings, incentives, conference and events that took place down at Dubai World Trade Centre. No big surprise to any of us out there. Numbers are up. Number of events is up. Number of people is up. So we will dive into those numbers a little later on.
Right. Well, our set of numbers is the numbers from the Parkin IPO. We'll be going through these as well in detail with Dean. We knew it was going to be oversubscribed. The question was how much? The answer was 165 times.
So you look at this in a lot of detail, and you've looked at these IPOs, a lot of them, in really quite granular detail. Is Parkin just more of the same? It's Salik 2.0, or is there something unique about it? What's the Brandy Scott take?
I would put it in the same basket very much of Silicon that people will say to you it's a population play. Is it 60%? I mean, you went off and spoke to the Parkin CEO that they expect the number of parking spaces to rise or parking demand to rise over the next X number of years. We know there are big plans to grow the population here in Dubai. I mean, Salika's car's on the road, Park and his car's waiting to get back on the road. So I would put them in the same area, if you know what I mean. Taxi's slightly different because taxi's obviously an awful lot more skewed, maybe than the other two, towards tourism. They've got the concession down at the airport, DXB. And if you're here on holiday, you're more likely to be taking a taxi or a ride-hailing service, aren't you, than renting a car, I think.
Yeah.
So we will look at the parking numbers in a bit more detail. We're asking what the amount of money that was put on the table, which is 165 times more than people actually got in shares, what it says about our appetites for IPOs at the moment in general. GSB Capital in a little bit later.
Can we also do the wild speculation about who might be next with GSB Capital? Because we like that game, don't we?
We're pretty much assuming that it is going to be a fine purveyor of groceries, are we not?
Could well be.
Urquhart looks confused.
No comment. No comment, Your Honour.
No comment.
Couldn't possibly. Vested interests.
What is... I mean, we look at trends as well here on the Business Breakfast. We like to be able to group things into wide and probably inaccurate baskets. Two things I've noticed in the last couple of days on the show that we've done, or that the numbers have done. One is we've started asking almost everybody from a local or regional company that comes in if and when they're going to IPO, or if they have plans, or if they're having the chat. That's kind of new. The other thing is international earnings are all talking about whether or not they're having a good China.
Yes. You looked at the Lego numbers earlier this week, and they were having good America but bad China, weren't they? I'm not saying that's typical, but that was the Lego take.
Yeah, Adidas mentioned China. It's, if you look at what the executives are actually talking about in the earnings calls, everyone has to say, yep, China, no, China, expectations, China. Ditto the reports that are coming out from, you know, IEA, the International Energy Agency, that's just come out with its oil forecast for the year. So it does seem that is very much where attention is. Just two things that I've noticed in our chats this week.
This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Well, let's get some more insight now on those big international stories, particularly big American stories. We've got everything from TikTok to Trump. We've got oil to interest rates, and it's Oscars week as well. So we're still dissecting that Ken performance. Who we thought can we get to discuss all of these things? And the name that came up in our editorial meeting was the polymath Jason Schenker. He is president and chief economist of Prestige Economics. He's also chairman of the Futurist Institute, and he joins us now live on the line from Austin, Texas. Jason, good morning. How are you?
Morning, Richard. Good to be here.
Lots to dig our teeth into this morning. Can we start with TikTok? Front page of My Financial Times this morning, this is the headline: China accuses the US of robber's logic in TikTok ban as Steve Mnuchin prepares a bid. I'm going to get your thoughts on this, but first of all, let's hear from Steve Mnuchin, former Treasury Secretary under Donald Trump, now running a private equity firm. This was him doing the rounds on the TV networks yesterday saying he wants to buy TikTok.
You know, when I was Treasury Secretary, I chaired CFIUS, and CFIUS approved, and I had President Trump sign an order that TikTok had to be sold. And I continue to believe that. So I think the legislation should pass, and I think it should be sold. I understand the technology. It's a great business, and I'm going to put together a group to buy TikTok.
You're trying to buy TikTok?
I am, because this should be owned by a U.S. businesses. There's no way that the Chinese would ever let a U.S. company own something like this in China.
What do you make of this?
Well, I think the biggest thing here is there is a lot of pressure. There is concern. You know, in the U.S., we hear how far apart Democrats and Republicans are. But on this issue, there is a lot of bipartisan agreement. You can see that in the votes in the House. And it has a lot to do with concern about data and what the level of control there is that ByteDance has over TikTok, which is why we've seen now Congress push forward where either the two companies have to be separated, right, where TikTok has to become a separate entity that is not controlled by ByteDance, or else it will be subject to a ban.
Okay. Can this actually happen, though? All the commentary I've heard is that maybe it can get over the political hurdles through the Senate and if Joe Biden's still president. But what about legal challenges?
At the end of the day, if this becomes the law of the land, there may be legal challenges, but some of this stems from national security concerns. So, I mean, there always can be various court cases and things like that. But in the meantime, the ban would come into effect. And I suspect that if this were to be pushed through Congress and approved in the Senate, now that it's passed the House, and then it were to be signed into law by the president, I can't currently envision what the Supreme Court would overturn it for, but you'd have to go through a lot of different legal and court cases. And in the meantime, I doubt there would be a stay that would prevent it from being shut down. But it does seem more likely. I mean, as you've noted, Steve Mnuchin and others can see an opportunity here, and the American public, you know, broadly does enjoy using these kinds of apps. But the problem is the data tied to it and what the national security risks therein are.
Let's talk about some of the other stories. I know you're covering oil front and center, trading at a four-month high at the moment here in the UAE. Brent crude, the one we watch here, is above $85 a barrel. West Texas Intermediate, where you are, is above $81 a barrel. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's a couple things, right? I mean, OPEC's curtailing production. We had that announcement earlier this month where, against the backdrop of already low global oil inventories, production already being curtailed, additional announcements of a number of OPEC plus member countries holding back production even further out of concern around global growth. And if we look at the trend since the beginning of the year, we've seen a trend of oil prices moving higher. I think there are a few key factors here to consider. One is, of course, you know, moving to contract roles where we're going to be trading U.S. May crude, and that's summer driving season crude, looking at the U.S. economy, which has one of the biggest seasonal drivers of oil prices in the world, that summer driving season. We're trading May WTI. You know, if that becomes the prompt month in this kind of dynamic where we have strong jobs, strong economy, all of those factors are price supportive, especially with low inventories and curtailed supply from OPEC plus.
In terms of what's happening in the United States, we follow very closely here in the Middle East shale oil production. And frankly, we don't particularly like it. We don't like non-OPEC oil producers churning out billions of or millions of barrels of the stuff. But we know over the past decade or so, it's been a big story. Where do we stand now with shale oil production in a high interest rate environment? Are the shale oil producers still pumping?
Well, we're still seeing a lot of shale oil production, and we're still likely to see more shale oil production. And at the end of the day, the notion that we no longer need oil is something that I think people are coming to the realization that it would be a very, very long time before that could ever feasibly happen. And we do think, of course, going forward, because we see rises in global population, rises in real per capita GDP on a global basis, that oil demand growth is likely to rise on planet Earth, right? So there's going to be more demand for oil in the years ahead. And especially in this kind of tight environment, that means that the oil that's being produced is likely to find a market. So we do see more shale oil continuing to be produced, but obviously in high interest rate environments, it's difficult to get new projects funded. But we do see that continuing to be something where there is production. And I think the most important thing, of course, is that, you know, we see strong growth in the U.S. We see globally population rising. Those factors are strong. And of course, with such a strong labor market in the U.S. summer driving season this summer is going to be the biggest ever. And that is very likely to be something that could drive oil prices higher still in the months ahead.
Very quickly, when are we going to reach, if ever we do, peak shale? The point where shale production has reached its peak and it gradually begins to decline. Here in the UAE, experts I speak to, geologists, say the UAE could pump at these levels for another 100 years quite happily. Maybe not the case with shale oil, but when will that moment come? What's the best guess?
I don't have a specific guess on exactly when that can happen, but shale is very different than conventional oil supplies because when you pump the well, right, the decline curve of production is much steeper for shale. And so you need to keep drilling more and more wells in order to get more and more production, as opposed to conventional finds where you have in the UAE and and other parts of the Middle East, you have the oil that's there and you can pump it for years, decades, maybe longer. But for shale, you just have to be drilling more and more and more. And at some point, that will reach declining returns as well.
Let's get more on the markets now. Our guest this morning is Jason Schenker, President and Chief Economist of Prestige Economics, joining us live from Austin, Texas. Jason, thanks for staying with us.
Pleasure to be here, Richard.
Let's talk about inflation. Let's talk about interest rates. Next Wednesday, we have the decision from the Federal Reserve. I'll get your thoughts on that in a second. First of all, let's get the thoughts of the man who matters. Jerome Powell is the head of the Fed. This was him speaking last week to Congress about inflation.
We believe that our policy rate is likely at its peak for this tightening cycle. If the economy evolves broadly as expected, it will likely be appropriate to begin dialing back policy restraint at some point this year. But the economic outlook is uncertain, and ongoing progress toward our 2% objective for inflation is not assured. Reducing policy restraint too soon or too much could result in a reversal of progress we've seen in inflation, and ultimately require even tighter policy to get inflation back to 2%.
So, Jason, to use a Texas analogy, we know the Fed's going to stick next week on interest rates, but when is it going to twist?
I think that the earliest we could expect the Fed to cut rates would be June of this year, but that's if there's a lot of progress on inflation. Our base case scenario is that it doesn't actually happen until Q3 of 2024, because as we saw just this week, you know, if there's a lot of progress on inflation, you know, they could cut rates in June. But the if's bigger, right? Given how we saw the CPI, it's still year-on-year rates, total CPI at 3.2%, the core at 3.8%, and the PPI report out that this week, that also was stronger than expected for inflation. We saw accelerations in total PPI and core PPI as well, even though they're still relatively low levels. And for that CPI, you know, the Fed's target for consumer inflation is 2%. You do not need to be an award-winning economist to know that 3.2% and 3.8% are still a long way from 2%.
Finally, can't let you go, Jason, without asking you about movies, because as well as being all of the things that we mentioned, you've also entered into the world of movie production. We'll get onto your movies in a second. First of all, though, I want to get your reaction to Oscars and the state of the US movie industry in general. And it's a good excuse to play my favorite bit of the Oscars ceremony last Sunday night, which was Ryan Gosling and his performance of the song I'm Just Ken.
I'm just Ken. Where I see love, she sees a friend.
What did you make of the Barbie snub and Oppenheimer cleaning up?
Well, I think Oppenheimer had a lot of very positive things going for it in terms of the story and the production quality and a lot of that, right? Obviously, Barbie got a lot of attention domestically and globally as sort of a pop culture favorite. But you know, what the Academy often looks for is movies with a bigger message, movies that are made in a certain way, in a certain style, and Oppenheimer was more aligned with that than Barbie.
Finally, what about you in the movies? Following you on LinkedIn, you're one of America's most closely watched economists, and there you are making movies. What's the deal? We've got 60 seconds left, Jason.
Yeah, so the production crew that I've worked with for many years, they produce a lot of the online courses I've made that over a million people have taken, and they wanted to make a movie, and they ended up making a short, and the short is People Walk Dogs Late at Night in the Suburbs, and we were able to get SAG exemptions, and we were able to get a very talented SAG actor to star in it, Matthew Daddario. He's been in a number of TV shows. And the writer of both the feature and of this short, Drake Wooten, very talented young man. And it made something called the Blacklist, which is a Hollywood insider list of feature scripts that don't get made into full features, but should be. So very optimistic for this. I was on the Sony lot just last week out in Hollywood, overseeing the final mixing with people who've done final mixes and for the sound for David Lynch's movies. There was another one of our team had done Schindler's List. You had a lot of folks who've been tied to Emmy-winning or Academy Award-winning things. And really excited for it. We submitted to Cannes, Venice, and Locarno just yesterday.
Ten
so we're very excited to see what will happen.
Wish you the best of luck with that. Thanks very much indeed for joining us today.
Thank
Jason
you
Shenker,
so much.
President, Chief Economist, Prestige Economics from Austin, Texas.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Right, let's lump a bunch of those numbers from our headlines together and have a look at what they tell us, not just about IPO appetite here in the UAE, but what's happening with the local and the global economy. Very pleased to be joined in the studio now by Dean Campbell, who's Chief Commercial Officer at GSB Capital. Dean, good morning. Lovely to see you.
Good morning, Brandy.
Let's start with the Parkin IPO. 165 times oversubscribed. The oversubscription was a given. But the 270 billion dirhams odd put down in orders is really something else. Why do you think Parkin captured the imagination so much?
Yeah, I mean, the bottom line is the numbers are absolutely staggering. So this is the sixth IPO that the Dubai government have launched as part of their 2021 plan. There'll be another four that they will look to launch. But yeah, in dollar terms, that's 71 billion that have ultimately been put on the table. I think you've seen the appetite both from institutional, professional and retail investors, particularly to invest into government entities here in the region, is high. And with these businesses generating high cash flow, these are businesses in which they want to invest.
Well, 12% of the shares went to retail investors, which meant that the vast lion's share has gone to qualified and institutional investors. What do we know about who's buying on that side?
It'll be a mix of both banks as well as possibly family offices and different types of investors. I think what you've seen, though, is that because a number of the local banks have had access to these types of investments, you're seeing much high-profile access, both from a diverse base of investors. So I think the bottom line is, come back to the point I mentioned before, that these businesses are highly cash generative, and ultimately that's what clients are looking for. They're looking to invest into companies who generate good levels of cash, are highly profitable, and they're going to be able to both, number one, grow and also build a steady income stream from them.
Are you guys over at GSB Capital, you look after people's money, are you including these local IPOs or the shares once they're listed in your client portfolios?
So yeah, so this is something that we'll advise and speak to clients about. It's not something that we personally actively promote. Clearly, a number of the local banks here have been having that as part of their offering. But if clients hold those assets and then we move to custodize those assets with GSB, that's something that we can do.
But why aren't you recommending them as part of a portfolio sort of, you know, proactively from yourself? You're based here, but you're obviously trying to do the best you can for your clients' money. So what's the thinking over at GSB?
So, I mean, as a business, we fundamentally focus on financial planning and wealth management. As part of that, we look to the long term, as evidence-based investors. Individual single-line securities will be part of that. Typically, we will outsource a lot of that recommendation, whether that be to external discretionary fund managers or to private banks to make those recommendations. So whilst we will be there to actually put the plan in place, some of the investment decisions will be outsourced.
Okay. But the other thing we were discussing this morning was ETFs, Bitcoin ETFs. Tom's been having a chat to one Bitcoin bull about them. I know we've got a lot of rules in place when it comes to crypto. We were chatting to the head of legal at the DIFC yesterday about exactly that. What's your position, though, on the Bitcoin ETFs at the moment? What can and can't you do?
So we are a DIFC-regulated firm. As part of our permissions, we do not have crypto permissions as part of that. That's a conscious decision that we make. That said, clients can invest into crypto assets. Like you say, that the launch of a number of ETFs, particularly in the US, has grown over the past 6 months. So we can facilitate those investments, but it wouldn't be something that we would personally advise on as part of our portfolio recommendations. But we can actually facilitate and transact on that basis.
But you've made that decision, and it's the thinking that I'm really interested in. Why have you made that decision?
Number one, I don't think we've necessarily got the expertise. It's still, I believe, a kind of a young market. And for us, whilst it is it's an asset which is growing in popularity, for us, traditional wealth management through the ways that we've been working, we stick to what we're really, really good at. That said, like I said, so we can facilitate, and we do work with a number of private banks who have specific crypto desks where you can actually speak to investment directors, specialists who actually invest into these areas as well.
Well, let's have a look at some of the other numbers that I know you have been looking at. Good bellwethers for what's happening, local economy and global economy. We've got the DP World numbers out, 33% drop in adjusted net profit, and Majid Al Futtaim, 12% rise in net profit overall, but obviously different numbers coming out from different parts of the business. Why do we look at these two companies in particular?
Majid Al Futtaim, a huge conglomerate that operate in the region. I think in every aspect of life, we touch them in some capacity during our working week. So I think it's an important aspect to look at what those numbers look like. I think first and foremost, they've taken the decision and had the foresight to diversify their business over the last five, it's probably a little bit longer than that, five plus years. So moving into, we all know them from a retail perspective, but moving into property, moving into digital retail as well as entertainment, they've really diversified that business. And I think that's an important aspect of how they've actually grown that business. Clearly, there were some points in terms of the numbers which were negative, particularly around retail. But as a business, they've got multiple income streams, and I think they're in a strong position. I think the key question to ask really is that, and obviously we've heard about inflation earlier, and obviously the Fed decision next week. I personally believe we're kind of at that peak point in terms of rates. But the question is that how much of that growth was driven by inflation, either people paying more money, and two, is that going to continue into the future?
So the question of whether or not we're reaching peak profits is one of rockets and feathers, isn't it? That prices go up like a rocket, but they come down a lot slower like a feather when it comes to corporates reducing profits. Where do you think we are in that cycle?
It's the million-dollar question, though. It's very, really difficult to tell. I mean, I think what's really interesting is that I was here and I was looking at my diary. It was about 12 months ago. It was just after the Credit Suisse bailout by UBS. And there was a lot of concerns or worries at that point in time. Now, if we fast forward 12 months, a lot's happened during that period of time. And actually, it's been, by and large, very, very positive. So it's really difficult to say in terms of where we're going to be in 12 months from here. I think the key thing is, both if I look at both Majid Al Futtaim and also DP World, what those numbers will look like in 12 months from now, because potentially we are in that position in terms of peak profits. Ultimately, a big part of that is how much money people can spend on those individual business lines. So I haven't really answered it, but it's difficult to say in terms of where we are. But yeah, lots of factors at play.
Well, thank you so much for coming and giving us your thoughts this morning. Dean Campbell is Chief Commercial Officer at GSB Capital. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Investments go up and investments go down. Before putting your hard-earned money into any investment, Dubai Eye 103.8 advises you to always do your own background research. Ensure you're informed to navigate the market and any potential pitfalls. Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Size Business Breakfast.
Let's talk all things cryptos. Why DIFC have been very proactive when it comes to their approach to digital assets. More updates on their latest laws in recent times. Plus, of course, you can't get away from the Bitcoin story at the moment. It is on an absolute run at present. Let's get some input into that one. And we welcome into studio. It's not so much a case of poaching turn gamekeeper, but more a case of avid listener turn special guest this morning. Why? Because our next guest is an individual, a man who has commented hugely about all things Bitcoins for many years now, before many of us even knew what Bitcoin was. He is a keen enthusiast of all things Bitcoin. He's a keen enthusiast of all things Austrian economics. He is Arno Kahr, joining us live here in studio. It is so nice to put a face to the name. Arno, welcome.
Nice. And nice to meet you guys.
Great to have you on board. Before we get on to the big stories around all things Bitcoin, all things crypto, etc., why are you a Bitcoin? When did your sort of relationship with Bitcoin start? And what is it that's enthralled you so much about it?
Well, like most of the people, you know, obviously we've been all been kind of, we've seen this crypto going on into value for over the years. And back in 2017, I was kind of like, wow, what is this exactly? And then, and therefore I started to, you know, buy a little bit like everyone else. And obviously you go through this this period where perhaps you can do some big loss. And that's why I think it's this, the AFC and the VARA laws are very quite important. But then again, then I started to wanted to study about Bitcoin, you know, because I want to know what it is. And I think this is what I'm urging people to do, you know. You know, crypto is good, but you need to learn about it. So take your time, be curious. And this is why actually I've taken those books today, because I'm going to give them to you guys. These books are very important. And this is where I started to learn about Bitcoin, which obviously also took me to learn more also about Austrian economics.
You've been a huge bull for all things Bitcoin for many years now. And, you know, that one would forgive you for doing the old told you so on a week like this. I'm looking at the numbers. It's fairly extraordinary. Bitcoin racing to an all-time peak above $72,000 at the beginning of the week. That continues its upwards trends. Okay, yeah, we know it's a little bit volatile. It's come back a little bit from there, 68,270. But who's to say where it's going to be at the end of the show? Why are we seeing this increase in value at the moment?
Okay, so the increase of value, I think what is very important is what I think is going up, first of all, is because our money is broken. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people now, what over the years, you know, when you see like the US dollars, the British pound, or even the euro, over the years, you know, this money is being debased and people are losing the their purchasing power. So I think more and more people now are trying to see where can I actually put my hard working money and how long, because, you know, it needs to, this value needs to be kept for a long time. That's what we call like lowering our time preference in the Austrian economics. But also what we've seen so far, you know, since January this year, you know, obviously the Bitcoin ETF has been accepted in America and the inflow has been incredible. It is the most successful ETF launch in, at all time, you know. So what we've seen is the, I've got some numbers there actually, you know, I think a couple of days ago we had an inflow going into the ETF, which was equivalent to $1 billion, which is equivalent of 13,000 Bitcoin in one day. So now if you look over the time, actually this ETF, are actually the inflow is about 4,000 Bitcoin a day. And when you look that, or when you see that actually the there's only 900 Bitcoin are being mined every day, this is what we call actually a stock, a shock, you know, the supply shock. Yeah, that's the word I was looking for. Now, what we are being also, what is going to be happening as well in April, we have
the halving.
Well, we have the halving.
What is the halving?
So sounds instead like of having 900 festival. New Bitcoin coming into the supply, we are going to get 450 Bitcoin going live, you know, obviously every day. So keeping the story a bit short, what's happening is obviously Bitcoin's got what we call the time chain. Mm. Well, you call that the blockchain, but it's on the time chain. We have those blocks. We have miners. We're actually trying to find those blocks, which each and every transactions are on that block. And in for a reward, the miners get at the moment 6.25 Bitcoin when they find this through iComputer.
So question, because a lot of analysts are saying that the price we're seeing at the moment is also is already reflective of that halving that comes in April of this year. The current prices are sort of reflecting that already. Is that the case or not?
I guess, yeah, lots of people are saying that it's actually priced in. But, you know, it's what we're talking about, supply shock. You know, when if you think of that, an average of 4,000 Bitcoin as an inflow in the ETF, this is not even including, obviously, pension scheme, which I believe they are taking their due diligence at the moment. But this could be even coming on later. And the retail as well has not even joined yet. Mm. So if you do some calculation or simple math, you know, if you take 4,000 Bitcoin out of the supply every day and you have a supply of, I think the reserve in the exchanges are about 2 million Bitcoin. Mm. So if you take that into consideration, plus the supply going being halved to 450 Bitcoin a day, mid-April. I mean, you can do your calculation yourself.
Listen, Bitcoin is in a great place. It's also prompted a little bit of a run on all things crypto. It's also prompted a number of governments and authorities to enact their regulatory authorities. How far advanced is the DIFC, the Dubai International Financial Centre? How important is their new digital assets law?
I think it's very important, but obviously in a Bitcoin world, you'll have, what we're saying is that you have Bitcoin, which is a fully decentralized, obviously, money.
Yep.
But you also have the altcoin, which we call that crypto on our side, because we consider them really they could be quite good projects, but we don't consider them as decentralized. They're actually centralized. They have an entity, which even that's including Ethereum, for example. So you'll have... You still have a small group of people actually taking decision on what this money should be, and that I can't really call that decentralized. Mm. When you look even at Ethereum having a new model upgrade every 6 months, and this is actually taking these decisions are taken by individuals. Mm. I don't really think that. So I think regarding the law, I think this is very important and it's really good, and they are doing that. I think it is really, really important, yes.
It's very proactive, and that certainly seems to be sort of incumbent with what all things Bitcoin is doing at the moment. I've got less than a minute with you, around about 30 seconds. You're an enthusiast of Austrian economics. Are the two sort of intertwined as well, this new approach to economics and Bitcoin? 30 seconds.
Yes, no, exactly. So what we think, the Austrian economics and Bitcoin, what we want to do is giving back the money to the people, right?
Yeah.
Every price in dollars are always going up. Everything around you is going up all the time. And obviously, we've seen that over the past. Everything priced in Bitcoin will go down in the future. And then what's happening to that is actually giving back the power to the people and the freedom to the people. And then it's what we call, freedom money.
So, it is fascinating. It really is fascinating. We have only scratched the surface with our Bitcoin today. But Arno, we will get you back to talk about this in more detail in the near future. We can't thank you enough, A, for listening to the show, B, for bringing in books, and C, for explaining all things Bitcoin. Thank you so much indeed. Arno Kahr, enthusiast of Austrian economics and Bitcoin.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com. You've been listening to a DubaiEye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from DubaiEye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.